This is the First Time Podcast.
Part reality series.
Part writer's masterclass. It's a podcast about the first time
you publish a book.
I'm Kate Mildenhall.
And I'm Catherine Collett. Welcome to The First Time.
Thank you so much for joining us for season three. We are super excited to be bringing you more than 20 brand new episodes this year with a whole range of talented folk.
And if you're joining us for the first time, welcome. You can go all the way back to season one to catch up with everyone we've spoken to so far and to hear how our own second book journeys are coming along.
If you are a long-time listener, forgive us, you've heard this before. Like just about every other podcast, we've got a Patreon page where you can pledge a few dollars a month to help us bring you this excellent ear content every fortnight.
Your money goes to paying Phoebe, our amazing producer, and covering the costs of recording studios and the back-end infrastructure. It is an enormous help to us. Thank you to our amazing Patreons so far. Patrons or Patreons, do you think?
Either. Both of them work.
Go to patreon.com/thefirsttimepodcast.
Hello, Catherine.
Hi, Kate. We're back.
We're back. And we just, because we're completely frank with you listeners, we're just saying we feel a little bit nervous talking to you again.
It's the studio,
It's the studio. It's making us feel all professional and grown up.
Cherry in here.
On my way in here today, Catherine, I listened back to our first episode last season, in season two, and we were both, you could hear the refreshed beach vibes about, we talked about our summers in our beautiful places and how we lay on the beach and read our books. That isn't quite what happened for us this summer.
It was a pretty tough summer all round, wasn't it?
It was a tough summer for everyone in Australia. But you had a tough summer. You ended up on a beach with fire approaching you.
We did. So we were on the south coast of New South Wales with a lot of other people. And we ended up standing on a beach watching the fire approach and the part of the scrub on the beach set alight. It was a pretty traumatic experience.
Completely terrifying. We have talked about this and debriefed in our own good time and won't do our full debrief on the air because you'll hear all our tears in general, fears and tears. But it was a full-on time. And then you had to come home like via Canberra?
We ended up going north was the way that we came home. So we got pretty close to Canberra. We went up through past Nowra and through the Kangaroo Valley. It's always nice to come home. That was a particularly nice homecoming.
Yeah. It's always nice to come home, except when you have to come home 3 weeks earlier than you anticipated.
I feel like that's a really hard part of it. Like, the country's burning. It's such a massive impact on people that live in areas.
Oh, my goodness.
The land, the planet, the animals, the whole lot of it. But then there's also a small part of you that is like, I've just spent 3 weeks with my kids now in our house with
in
no
Melbourne.
Plans. And
it's really expensive to do that.
It's really.
And they try and kill each other.
Yeah.
Yeah, there was a great article. I'll try and find it and link to it in Sunday Life, which was about grieving for a holiday and acknowledging all of those things.
Oh,
like we're privileged to be in this position, so small compared to people who have lost livelihood and houses and the entire country, as you say, but also that little grief.
Because you also did a fairly
we did.
Quick leave.
We were a bit dramatic. So we have the same kind of place that we go to every year. Me for the last 30 years, I think. And we had 15 minutes in the end to get out because of the new, what became the Mallacoota fire, which was impacting you as well.
Yeah.
Or you had other ones too.
We had the fire. I'm not sure what they called it. It came from the north.
Yeah.
And then the fire was coming from the south.
But yeah, so we got out, which is of course the thing, right? You get out. That's what's exciting. But I did really think, Catherine, that we were going back the next day. Like, I got the books, but I didn't get anything else out.
I thought it was all over, Kate.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah, see, it's completely like, different. You had this
like, we're at
deep
done.
Trauma on the at the time.
Yeah, it was tough.
Yeah, but we got out, came back. But we have just last week got all the photos of our melted camper trailer and bikes and everything we
but
left.
That's the thing. 15 minutes is like, I utterly, and we're going to link to a great essay by J.P. Pomare.
Is it
Pomare?
Yeah.
in which he talks about hating people saying this is the new normal. And I completely agree. I hate the level of apathy that is in that. But it also is, like, the 15-minute warning is
is the new thing. I think the most distressing part, though, and I haven't been able to show the photos to my kids, like, you know, melted trailer is a melted trailer, whatever, we can replace it. But looking at the photos of the of that bush, which I have, yearned for, that I yearn for every day of the year until I get down there, and it's so green and so beautiful, and the same branches fall in the same spot, you know, and have done for like 20 years, and it's just, you know, it burned pretty hot through there. There is nothing there. So,
is your plan to go back next year? Will you go back sooner?
I don't know if it will be open. The bridge is destroyed. So, you know, who knows when all those places are open. But, oh, my gosh, yes, back to, I love Cheria Pitt's spend with them thing that she did on Instagram. Like, go back, take an empty esky, go to Far East Gippsland or the south coast of New South Wales, spend your money.
Yep.
Those people, like, you know, Cairn River, where we stop, where you would stop and get your pies or whatever, you know, they've got, they have hundreds of thousands of visitors over the summer and they just have not.
Yeah, so it's pretty tough.
That was our little, that was our
abridged version of the fires.
A little summer. You said, what got you through though? Did you read any books while you were doing all of that, Catherine?
Very sort of, we lost comms and so all phone stuff and all power. And I took a Kindle and had planned to always just download the next book sort of as I finish
as
the one
when
before.
Required.
And the only book I had was a really old Matthew Shardlake that was still on the Kindle that I had never finished reading because, and I really like Matthew Shardlake. Have you read any of those?
No, I have not.
He's like a medieval hunchback detective.
Yeah, right.
And they're really epic novels.
Okay.
And I normally really enjoy them, but this one is
Well, when you
just,
only have one forced upon you, how can you possibly enjoy it?
So it was that and a 1,000-piece puzzle.
Oh, what was the puzzle
The puzzle was great. The puzzle had a really Where's Wally sort of vibe. I've never been a puzzle person.
Okay.
I think they should issue them in emergency packs.
That's such a good idea. Were the four of you doing it together?
No, I was just doing it by
myself. Oh, you were just getting through.
Well, Carney was doing a lot of sort of reconnaissance and stuff.
Yeah, of course.
But it's so meditative.
Yeah.
Really like a fabulous activity.
Great. Okay. It was 2020, the year of the puzzle.
The year of the puzzle.
Yeah, we got a good moon puzzle, actually. That was pretty cool. Very difficult, but very cool.
How many pieces?
It's not many, but it's round.
Oh.
And it's the surface of the moon, like it's a NASA photograph. So it's, but
so
anyway, it's
not
very
a
cool.
Lot of color.
It's very cool. The other thing that, of course, came out of the fires, if there is a positive, was the incredible Authors for Fieries campaign that was run by Emily Gale and Nova Wheatman and a whole host of incredible
so
authors doing
heartwarming,
so many
it?
Things. Although, you know, talking about we lost our summers, like I think that Emily and Nova lost their entire summers because it went off.
I think they were thinking 30,000 they'd make. And what was it? 300?
Oh, my gosh. I don't even want to. We need to check that.
We
need to
check
how much it made. But it was an enormous amount. We're very excited. We auctioned off a interview with us and we're very excited to be bringing that to you at some point later this year. And I'm really glad I had about 8 live bids in. I got outbid on a few of them, which was really good.
You're like a casino gambler.
I was a bit like a gambler. I was a bit like a gambler, but I'm very looking forward to doing my mindfulness sessions with Rosie Chang. I'll update you and let you know how they go.
Oh, very nice.
So tell us, you did the puzzle and then when you got home, did you read anything?
I read heaps after that. After that,
good.
I finished that bloody Shardlake book.
Okay, good.
I think I can disparage the Shardlake book. It's Tombland is the one because his other ones are so good.
Oh, okay.
And also he's, you know, well loved. Doesn't need my sort of.
Will I put this on my reading? I read a couple of ones that you recommended this year. One of them I was reading over the evacuation point and I thought I'd lost it because I lost my notebooks. I left my notebooks in the trailer and they've burned, which is a shame. But I thought I'd also lost Prep, Curtis Sittenfeld, which was in the trailer. But I found out that I'd put my sister and my books like in a really secret part of the car. Who knows why?
Oh my gosh.
The things that I packed, honestly.
Yeah. What is,
you know,
so
like
you
a
made
bottle
the
of bubbles and some books and who knows? Oh. Anyway, so I found it again. So I did finish it.
Oh, nice.
I really liked it, but she's a hard protagonist to like in Prep.
I haven't read it in such a long time. I like all Curtis's books, but she's about that to me. A lot of her books, maybe her early ones, are that in your 20s
experience,
which is so
dry,
angsty,
and angsty, so
searching
good.
For love.
Anyway, I interrupted. Keep going. I was saying, should I read Shard Lake, or are you saying no, Kate?
No,
this is not for you.
No, probably not.
Okay, great. Keep going.
It's a bit Ken Follett-y. Any Ken Follett?
Yeah, I have.
Yeah. Oh, gosh.
I have because
they're
dads.
Sorry, Ken, if you're listening.
Sorry, Ken. We'll interview you in season 4. Okay, carry on.
Helen Gardner's Diary. It's a dip in, dip out. I was just thinking when you said you have lost your notebooks, you don't get the Helen Gardner Diary
moment.
I don't get to.
You know what? In 20 years, there'll be a little section that's like burned. This bit
you should
burned.
Just release a notebook that is like a nod to the fires.
Yeah, nice. I don't think I'm famous enough, quite famous enough yet, Catherine. It's amazing though.
I feel like that diary will influence writers' diaries to come because I feel like I have always felt with journaling that I had to do so much of the setup.
Yeah.
But she just does the moment.
She just
like
does the moment.
Two paragraphs on the moment.
I've actually started, because of her, I've started this year like just writing some things that happened in the day, like in my little, you know, my tiny little moleskin that I have, just so that there is that kind of collection of stuff that happened.
Yeah.
Mm, okay.
It's really good. The other one is I watched a lot of The Crown. Have you watched The Crown?
I haven't watched this season.
It's really good. Yeah, you do need to Google the whole time because some of the things that happen seem to be so extraordinary. But because of that, I read Queen Victoria by Julia Baird. Really good.
Yeah, that's on my like long-term
list. Just
talk
about Queen Victoria getting like what you think of when you think of Queen Victoria, sort of dowdy, constantly mourning, very sort of conservative. You get a very different woman in these books.
I'm really excited.
Another book that I'm reading at the moment is Robin Cadwallader's book, The Anchoress. Have you read it?
I have read it and I loved it.
It's so good. It's a phenomenal book. So it's set, I don't even know what century it would be set in, but it's a woman, young woman, who has elected to live in a very tiny,
tiniest
room
space
attached to a church for the rest of her life, basically.
It just makes me be able to quite breathe enough when I'm thinking about it.
And she has a little hole kind of thing where the maids pass things in and out, and that's basically it. I think she has contact with the maids, and then she has contact with the priest, basically, to hear
confession. Extraordinary book.
It's amazing. But what really interested me in that book is, so my book is set across 3 days, a very condensed time period, and Robin's obviously set in a really small space. But the similarity is in that what happens for her, that tiny, tiny space, so much of what is interesting happens outside that space, and the way in which she particularly has brought the past in a really seamless way into the present.
Yeah. That's so interesting. I reckon that Charlotte Wood talked about that in our interview with her last year, in terms of, because The Weeknd is across 3 days as well, and that thing about limits and what you can do
limitation. Like I really have... That has been a real challenge in the book that I've been working on, and it's so interesting to see how someone else has approached a problem that is different. But
you know, there's another excellent I've talked about Nina LaCour's podcast before, and she's just released a new kind of mini season, and there's an episode in there on backstory and the different ways people put it in. So it's only about 12 minutes.
Amazing.
We'll put the link in the show notes, but it was really good. It was talking about that exact thing. How do you get it in, and what structural forms do you kind of use to get it in?
Yeah.
Excellent. Okay. Things for us to look
toss
at.
To you for and reading.
Reading, I had a good one. I'm going to mention a few because you can always, of course, go on my Instagram and see exactly what I'm reading.
You're going to do that this year?
I have. I've started. So what Kate read next is my little hashtag that the lovely Lorinda gave me. It's good. It's so good to be able to go back.
Yeah,
I really do forget. One of the ones that is very relevant to our audience is Before and After the Book Deal by Courtney Baum. Who is a US writer. It is such a good book. Now, Jane Rawson recommended this on Twitter, so I had it on pre-order from Booktopia.
It's only just come out.
It's only just come out. So it's really relevant in terms of now. It is US-centric a little bit, but you can apply all the same stuff across. dip in, dip out, depending on where you're up to. So it starts before. So if you're kind of finishing a manuscript, you're unagented, you're querying, et cetera, really relevant to you. But also all the way up through publication, book promotion,
she should do a
all
podcast.
The feelings. She's been interviewed a few times. I'll see if I can find a link. And a lot of collected wisdom of other people as well. So it's just a really good one to dip in and out
great
of and
one.
To make you feel kind of normal again. I read The Lotus Eaters by Emily Clements, who is our RMIT alumni, and Catherine and I were both in an early class with her. It's just so fabulous. I went to her launch a couple of weeks back, and, you know, she's also just thrilled and nervous and all those things. We are going to speak to her this season, so you'll get to hear from her. Another good one, Lapse by Sarah Thornton. Now, I think that's the first of a couple. That was her debut. I think it's text. I don't know if it's text. Great crime, you know, ex-lawyer kind of turned a woman who's turned coach of the local footy team in a regional Victoria. It's really good. My husband just raced through it as well. So that's a really good one. And I did finally, your other recommendation, I finally read Fleischman's in Trouble.
What did you think? This is like a divisive book,
I'm
beginning
to realize. It really is divisive.
Yeah.
And so I read it knowing that you'd recommended it and that heaps of people had, but also that it was divisive. I was fascinated. I did a lot of reading about the author at the same time. So I was really fascinated by her approach.
She inhabits a male perspective so well.
And he's divisive. I mean, the character's so divisive.
Well, you were empathetic to him to a point, and then it's like, oh, dude,
yeah. Oh my gosh. Yeah. So, but I loved being, you know, I like reading the books that everyone's talking about as
yeah,
well to
good.
Be part of that conversation.
Because you can generally see both sides.
Yeah,
you know,
absolutely.
It's never that it's one or the other.
But very interesting. And I listen to and would love to recommend Madeline Dorr, who does Extraordinary Routines, which I subscribe to, and I love her interviews that she does. She's got a new podcast called Routines and Ruts. I think it's up to about episode 7. It's just started this year, where she talks to creatives about their routines and how they get through the creative process. So really good.
Great.
Highly recommend. We'll link to it.
One listening one for me is The Last Voyage of the Pong Sue. Have you listened to it?
I haven't listened to it, but I've been reading it kind of in the Age. You know, like they do articles on it.
Good.
Yeah.
So this is a North Korean boat that came to Australia doing a heroin, a massive heroin bust,
yes,
essentially.
Like,
and it unravels the investigation.
On the Great Ocean Rose.
Yeah,
or something. Like,
just phenomenal. And I think the thing that nonfiction does so well in podcasts is that incorporation of real interviews. You have the actual voice of different people talking.
So well,
it's
and
fabulous.
Well produced.
And that is so. The Age investigative journalists have put the podcast together, sponsored by the TAC. So the TAC plug it all the time. And then they do, this is just interesting as a business model for a podcast. And then they have for Age subscribers special additional episodes, which is quite a good setup.
Yeah, that's
for
a
them.
Nice way of doing it. Mm. Someone's got to make money out of podcasts at some stage, right?
A lot of work in that too.
So.
Well, that's it. That's reading and listening.
That's reading and listening. That's what we did this summer. And we've got a whole year of episodes coming at you.
I'm very excited. I think we've got some really cool guests coming up.
So am I. And the nerves are all gone now.
One of which is in this episode.
Excellent. Who are you talking to?
So this episode, we're going to be talking to Australian author and screenwriter Christian White. Christian White's first book, The Nowhere Child, was one of Australia's best-selling debut novels ever. An early draft of the novel won the 2017 Australian Premier's Literary Award for an unpublished manuscript. Since publication, The Nowhere Child has been shortlisted for major awards and rights have sold in 16 territories around the world and were acquired in a major screen deal by Anonymous Content in the US and Carver Films in Australia. Christian's keenly awaited second book, The Wife and the Widow, was published by Affirm Press in October 2019. Christian, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm very excited to be here.
So we're going to talk about The Nowhere Child and The Wife and the Widow, but we might start at the very beginning. Mm. Did you always want to be a writer?
I did forever. So since I was really, really little, I was growing up, obsessed with Roald Dahl and Enid Blyton and all those sort of books. And I I was really little when I realized I wanted to tell stories, but it wasn't until I was maybe 16 or 17 that I thought, oh, I could do it. Maybe I could try to do this for a living. I remember writing a short story in my literature class, and my teacher, Mr. Bailey, read it out. You know, he was impressed by it, and he read it out. I can't really remember what it was about. I think it was about a guy finding an abandoned baby on the doorstep or some weird thing like that.
But so thriller crime.
It was thriller. Yeah, yep. Thriller crime horror. And he read it out, and I remember thinking, oh, I want to kind of chase this feeling.
So you'd love this
kind
of like...
Yeah. Yeah. And then I thought, okay, well, I'll be a writer. You know, how easy is that going to be? And I made a very, I instigated this deadline. I thought, okay, if I get to 25 years old, that's plenty of time. You know, I was 17 or something when I came up with this. 25 is so old. If I get to 25 years old and I haven't become this famous, amazing, best-selling author, I'll kind of get a backup career and I'll go back to uni and maybe become a teacher or something. And then 25 came and went, and this sort of shocking...
So did you go to uni to study writing?
I studied screenwriting. Yeah. I studied screenwriting because I thought it was I'm doing quotation marks for your listeners. I thought it was more realistic way to make money from your writing. I thought, okay, well, I'll study screenwriting.
Yeah, that was choice.
Which you know, ultimately really helped with writing the books, I think.
It did
teach me, you know, it teaches you about structure and dialogue and all that, three-act structure and all those sort of things. But for me, my problem was never, I think I had to write a whole lot of bad stuff before I got to the good stuff. But for me, the problem was never output. I really love the craft. I love sitting down and I love doing it. The problem for me was always just getting my stuff out there. You know, the idea of showing anyone my work, even my best friends or you know, whoever I was dating, my mum, anything, it sounded like I said I was dating my mum. Whoever I was dating, comma, my mum, just to be clear.
It's
very important. But, you know, even the idea of showing those people closest to me my work was absolutely emotionally crippling, you know. So I was always really bad at that. And going to study writing is where I began to kind of allow myself to show people my work. And it was that kind of, I think that's really the biggest thing it gave me. And I'd never been around people, I never knew writers groups and stuff existed. I'd never been around people who were into had the same ambition as me and into the same stuff. And I found that really, that was really rewarding as well.
So you met those networks through uni?
Yeah. I mean, I met, you know, a group of friends that, you know, I'm thinking about it now, I don't see any of them anymore. But at the time, I did meet this group of friends who really, I think we kind of inspired each other and show, you know, and rallied around each other. And it was really this exercise in, you know, Stephen King calls it opening the door. He says that you should write with the door closed and rewrite with the door open. And what he means is, well, firstly, literally shut the door when you're doing your first draft, shut out your distractions, your kids, your cat, all that sort of stuff. But it also means it's your time to sort of be alone with your work, and you can kind of fudge plot points, and you can write without fear of judgment and without fear of failure. And when it comes to rewriting, he says, open the door, which, you know, that's when he sort of suggests that you invite other voices into the room. And that was such a difficult thing for me. And what studying writing allowed me to do was, yeah, just get a good opening that door and taking criticism and all, you know, it's great to have someone read your work and say, it's really great. But more often than not, they say, well, it needs work in this is rubbish. You fudged this. You screwed this bit up. And that's something you need to learn how to kind of take that as well and put your ego aside and all that sort of stuff.
There's an art to taking it. There's also an art to being able to distill what resonates and what. Because I think in those early stages, you can be too responsive sometimes.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I had an experience where, with jumping around a little bit, but I had an experience where my first, you know, when I got my manuscript was going to be published and all that sort of stuff. And I got a round of notes back from not just the Australian editor, but it had been sold into multiple territories by then, the Nowhere Child. And I got all these notes, and some of them were conflicting, and I did a draft and turned in a draft where I answered every single one of them, and my publisher had to say, oh, you've killed it. You need to go back to the previous draft and trust your instincts that, you know, led you to make certain decisions. And that was a really important lesson for me, because I became really hung up on trying to please everyone. And I wanted to listen to every single person's note, that I completely lost perspective. And it wasn't until I had that, you know, mortifying meeting with my publisher where he said, dude,
do you know how nice that is to hear as an outsider? I'm sure it's awful to experience. Totally awful. But because I think we see people's trajectory of success. You so rarely see, because you'd want, you obviously, you know, going ahead, spoilers.
Yeah.
But you won the unpublished manuscript competition in Victoria. Yep. So you sort of assume that that's a seamless path, but it's a lot more challenging.
But it's strange, because you don't, for me anyway, I always fantasized about becoming a published author. But if I envision my life beyond that line, it was this kind of big white wall. You know, I didn't really imagine what day-to-day life would be, what's going to be like, just to where it's your full-time job. And so when it happens, it's obviously incredible, but there's all these little niggly stresses and anxieties that you come across that you don't even realize. And all these lessons, you know, I feel like with each of the first books, I learned these major lessons where I had to really screw up. And then, you know, with the Nowhere Child, it was turning in that terrible draft and learning to trust myself. And with the Wife and the Widow, I got really into my own head. Maybe we'll get into it, but I got really into my own head writing the second book. I became obsessed with what my readers were wanting, and was it going to be too much like the first book or not enough like the first book? And the lesson I learned from that was, this is going to sound really wanky, but I have this kind of writing philosophy. I wish there was a less pretentious way to phrase it, but my writing philosophy is to only write stuff that I would want to read myself. And it wasn't until I kind of leaned really heavily back into that was that great lesson.
I'm very, very keen to hear and talk more about your second book. If we start with The Nowhere Child, you'd obviously been writing through university. You hit your 25th birthday.
25th birthday came and went, and I wasn't, this published amazing author, which was shocking to me. So I adjusted it a little bit. I said, well, I'm not ready to go back and get a backup job. You know, I'm going to give it a little bit longer.
So what do you do? Like, obviously, you need to work to make some money.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think that when you're an emerging writer, before you're, you know, making money from it, it's like a drug habit. You know, you can't stop, but you need to support it. So I was breaking into houses. No, I worked a whole bunch of bizarre, crazy, this weird list of jobs. I was I drove a little golf cart around a golf course selling sandwiches. That was a real job. I worked for Coca-Cola for a while. You know, when you get a bottle of Coca-Cola and there's a free call number on the side, at least there used to be, and if you want to call someone and yell at them,
called that number.
Well, yes. You may have come through to me. I worked for them for a while. My weirdest job was that I was a video editor for an adult film company, which is insane, but also where I met my wife. So it kind of, you know, it was kind of worth it.
Editing,
she was an editor.
Yeah, she wasn't.
But yeah, no, I worked all of these jobs, and I just, somewhere along the line, I decided to stop kind of writing to be a writer and just write for the love of writing. And really, that's when things change. And that's when I'd push my deadline to, I'm going to get to 30. And if I don't get to 30, you know, if I'm 30 and I'm not published yet, then I'll give up and all this sort of stuff. And I just blew past 30. I'm 38 now, you know. I got published when I was, publishing deal when I was 36. So, you know, it was a lot longer. It took me a lot longer than I intended. But somewhere between my 25th birthday and getting published, I really just decided to just write for the love of it. And I think as soon as I really just kind of let myself do that, and I'd stopped. Of course, I'd fantasize about being published, and I'd have these amazing, you know, these dreams about doing it for a living. But it was just by focusing on what I love about it that things really began to kind of change from there.
And so did you say, if we take The Nowhere Child, did you work on that over a long period of time?
Was it took me probably about 2 years to write, but so technically it took me 2 years, but really, if I sort of dissected a little bit, I think it really took me 15 years, because I wrote, it was the fifth manuscript that I'd attempted. Only the second one I finished, and the first I thought was anywhere near good enough to show anyone. So all of those manuscripts that came before it you know, recently it's funny because, you know, I've just signed for books 3 and 4 and I thought, oh, maybe I can look back to my old work and maybe there's a bit of stuff there I can salvage, and I can't. It's all really, really terrible. But I think
so
that was part of it.
All completely unrelated, these.
All completely unrelated. I will. They're tucked away in a drawer, and I think one day I will dig a hole in the backyard and put them in it and light them on fire because they're really, really bad. But I think it took me writing so many sort of bad things before I got good. And I think that, so I think in a way it took me much longer to write The Nowhere Child because I had to try, I had to get good at it and I had to write all these bad things. And, you know, I look back at my old work and I can just tell exactly who I was reading at that time because I just copy them. You know, I was reading Kurt Vonnegut a lot at this time. Oh, reading Chuck Palahniuk. You know, you can really see it. And I think that that was part of it too. It was about finding my own voice and, just allowing it to purge all that bad stuff before you get to the good stuff.
One of the things I really noticed reading The Nowhere Child is, and I think it's true of the thriller, crime, horror sort of genre, is how much tension just increases and increases and increases. How much do you think about tension when you're writing? Is it something you think about?
It's definitely something that I think about. A lot of time I try to let those sort of things be present in my mind, but I try not to focus on them too much. But every now and then I will, usually it's a different word per book, where I'll get a little post-it note and write a word on it. And it's funny you say tension because for The Nowhere Child, I just wrote tension on a post-it note and stuck it on my computer monitor because I like to kind of think of a word, and then every time I'm struggling in a scene or if I drift or anything, I think of that word and I think it just sort of takes me back. It sort of centers me a little bit. So I definitely thought a lot about tension. And I also make sure I always have enough plot to give each chapter. You know, at the end of each chapter, I imagine in my head that it's sort of like going to a commercial break, you know, on a TV show. Not that we even have commercial breaks anymore. But, you know, in the old days, you know, when before Netflix, you had to, oh my God, the ads are on, you have to run and you have to pee and you're going to get back and your brother's shouting, it's on, you know. And I kind of want,
me too.
I really miss that in a way. And then you watch something free to air and go, this is exhausting. But yeah, I always want enough, every chapter I want to release, I want to sort of drop usually a plot turn and a character moment. It is about thinking about tension, but it's also thinking having enough to keep it moving and just being aware of pacing as well. Because I think, you know, my favorite books, the whole things are really propulsive and fast paced, but you want that to build as it gets further and further. And I think I think 50% of it's, you know, you think about it, but the other 50% we're so well versed. We're all such good. We all read so much and watch so much that a lot of those things are just instinctual now. I think you find, I don't know if you find that as a writer, but you probably find you don't necessarily have to, sometimes if you focus too much on those sort of things, you become too aware of them. And so it's this real balance for me where I really like to think about it, but I also like to let it sort of be natural.
Sort of, it's the balance between micro and macro, isn't it?
Exactly.
Because you can try and create tension through having more things happen, but at some point, you know, it's one thing happening after another.
Exactly. And I think that if you don't care about the character that's involved, you don't really care about what's going to happen to them. So I think that it's just as important. I've read books that have got incredible plots, you know, but they not necessarily, I guess I can say this because he's dead, but Michael Crichton is one of my favorite authors, but he's kind of bad at character. Sorry if anyone's a huge, I'm a huge
You've
Michael Crichton.
You've just alienated our epic Michael Crichton audience.
He's an amazing author. You know, a lot of his books I love. I reread Jurassic Park all the time, but I find that his characters are often loosely sketched. You know, so for me, it's about really keeping that tension and keeping the peril. But first, you need to really care about the characters. So if something bad happens, you get upset.
And so also on The Nowhere Child, it is alternating time periods, one in third person and then the present in first person, written from a woman's perspective.
Yep.
Was that hard or it was not?
It's strange because I didn't even think about it until after it was published, and I know I'd start going to Q&As and people would say, yeah, how do you find writing a woman? And it's I'd never even thought about it. And I think that I've got kind of I have a real answer, and then I have an answer that I think is the truth that I had to sort of think of afterwards. The true answer is, very early in the process, I will usually, the way my ideas come is that I will get a hook. You know, if we, so with the Nowhere Child, it was, you know, what if you found out you were abducted as a kid and who you thought were your parents were your kidnappers. First that came, and then very, very shortly afterwards, I get quite a clear image of the central character. Mm-hmm. And with the first book and with the second, because the second is from, you know, two female perspectives as well, the truth is they just kind of materialized right. in my mind like that. And the answer that I don't know is true or not is that, you know, I don't know, I have a lot of sort of strong females in my life. You know, all my closest friends and a female, and I think maybe that it's weirdly easier to write from a female perspective.
That's interesting.
It's I don't quite understand it. You know, for the third book, it's a male perspective, and it's funny because I did an event with JP Pomar yesterday or the night before, and we were talking about this, how. He's written two books. We actually have very similar. Our second books are both from two different female perspectives and all that sort of stuff. Amazing books. If anyone hasn't read In the Clearing and Call Me Evie, they're amazing. But we were talking about how when you do start to write from a male perspective, it can feel really boring because I think writing women it feels a bit sort of different. And I don't know. It's a strange thing. But yeah, definitely for my third book. I'm doing a male perspective, but we'll see how it turns out. Maybe by the time it hits shelves, it'll be a woman. We'll see.
It'll have morphed. Okay, so you finish a draft of The Nowhere Child. Mm-hmm. The Victorian Premier's Unpublished Manuscript Awards are coming up.
Yep.
What happens?
It was super ambitious for me to enter, I think, the VPLAs, because previous winners were Jane Harper and Graham Simpson and Simpson, however you pronounce his last name. So it was... Really, I was really sure I wasn't even going to be shortlisted. For me, it was an exercise in opening the door, you know, putting my stuff out there. And I had, I was getting a tiny bit of screenwriting work. So I had a screenwriting agent and I went to her and I said, oh, here's this manuscript. Do you guys do books? You know, this was after Googling how to get a book published and all that sort of stuff. And then my agent suggested entering it into some competitions, because it just, before you hit publishers, it's a good, if you've been shortlisted or lucky enough to win, it kind of, you get to skip a few steps. So I did it as an exercise of, okay, I'm going to start getting it out there. I'm not sure why, but I was very skeptical about writing competitions. I had this idea that there would be thousands and thousands of entries and you wouldn't actually read, no one would read it. I don't know why I thought that. I just thought I wouldn't. I don't know why. I was just really skeptical about it.
It is a bit of an abyss to send off.
Yeah, it's a strange thing. And it feels sort of, oh, well, if I'm sending it to an agent or a publisher, then you see the end goal. I don't know. It was something weird.
It's a one-to-one transaction.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And now I've completely turned around. I so encourage anyone to go to competitions first, because what happened with me, you know, I was so sure I was going to lose that about 3 or 4 days before the shortlist was announced, I got an email from them and it said, in my weird, bizarre brain, it said, it was a rejection letter. It said, you know, thank you for entering. You've not been successful, but we encourage you to enter in the future and all that sort of stuff. So I, you know, I shed a tear and I moved on. And the shortlist was announced and I was refreshing the page because I wanted to know if there was anyone on it that I wanted, had to be jealous of, you know. I was like, oh, who's going to? And then I saw my name on the shortlist and I thought, oh my God, there's been some sort of mistake. So I went back to the email. And it just wasn't a rejection letter at all. It was really weird. It was a generic thing that went out, and it's sort of, you know, the awards night will be at 7 p.m. It was just information.
No kind of congratulations.
Nothing. No, it was so, well, I was, the other thing is I was in London at the time, which makes me sound, you know, quite fancy, but it was the 1 3-week period I'd left the country in, you know, 10 years. So that made it difficult as well, because I think they would have called, you know, otherwise. Anyway, I saw my name on, you know, on the shortlist and started to freak out. And
did you ever think, because your name is not a common name, but it is conceivable that there could be two Christian wives.
Yeah, well, and the title of the manuscript at the time was Decay Theory. And even though it was my name and my, you know, it had to be me, I still thought, oh, maybe they've got it mixed up. To be honest with you, when it wasn't until I sat down and I was signing my first publishing deal in the office at a firm press, I was sitting there signing, and it wasn't until then where I saw my name on the you know, on the contract, that I thought, okay, it's got to be me. It has to be. You know, I thought, what if they've got some sort of mix up? And you know, a title page. I all those things went through my head. because I, you know, I've got, I think like a lot of, well, a lot of people, but especially a lot of writers, you know, I have mad imposter syndrome. So I always assume that there's been a mistake or something. And then this crazy thing happened, you know, between getting shortlisted and the winner being announced, and I was lucky enough to win. But between that period, there had been a bidding war, you know, all these publishers who I had.
So had you, your screenwriting agent, were they, did they have carriage?
They handled that. And thank God, really, because I remember the first offer that came through was, for me at the time, I couldn't believe it. You know, I looked at the number, the amount, and I thought, oh my God, I'm going to pay off my credit cards and all this kind of crazy stuff. And I was in London. I remember, you know, I was emailing my wife and my mum, and I remember my mum wrote back to me and said, you've got to take it right now. They're going to take it away. You've got to say yes. And thank God I didn't, you know, thank God my agents were there to field other offers, because what eventually happened was, you know, the offer that we took was, you know, significantly higher, you know, life-changing. And I remember when I got the news, when we kind of got the offer that we ultimately took, it was really early in London, and it was really, really loud. And I was walking through Soho, and I had to sort of duck into this alleyway to take the call because I couldn't quite hear. And it was this alleyway that it smelled like pee. It was garbage. It was this gross. And I was about, 6 inches from this brick wall, and I heard the offer, and I burst into tears. And I remember looking to my right, and there was a garbage man there. And we met eyes, and he quickly looked away. And I always think, he must have thought I'd been dumped, or I just found out there was a death in the family. And really, it was just this incredible, it was a life-changing moment, you know. So it was, and so I rushed back, and I was Skyping my wife and all that sort of stuff.
Like that bubble of who you share a moment with, even though they don't know they're sharing the moment.
It's weird. It's strange. It's so interesting to me. And I often find myself thinking about that guy. I'm sure it was just a blip. He probably thought, oh yeah, this guy's just been dumped, or he's a junkie, or who knows what he thought. But it is strange. So you don't know. Yeah, it's pretty incredible. And with bad news as well, you know, if you get, you might be on a tram and someone gets really terrible news, and there's just something interesting about interesting about that.
Merging of internal and external worlds.
Yeah, exactly. So it was incredible. And then from there, what it allowed me to do winning the competition was just skip a few steps. And, you know, all these publishers who I was trying to get my work in front of, suddenly they're coming to you. And it really is amazing. And it's also good for marketing and all that sort of stuff. But it's tricky though, because it was also, I mean, fantastic, and I loved every second of it, but it was also really overwhelming, because it was that white wall that I'd envisioned, where, you know, you reach this white wall, you've been published, now what? And then beyond that white wall, you have to make all these decisions, you know, about who am I going to go with? Am I going to go with a big publisher or a small publisher? And it was an amazing problem to have, but it was really tricky. And, you know, it was fantastic, but it's its own set of stresses.
Well, the high of that too is so, you know, there's an other side to it, but it's so like more. As particularly, I imagine, as you sold other countries and all, like it's such a writing to be a process that is so solitary and relatively internal and stable, to have this whole outside clamoring.
Yeah, and it all happened so quickly. And then as soon as I had the publishing deal, you know, we were going out to other territories, and it was like you said, we got US and UK, and we got France, and there was all these China, you know, all these kind of weird, not weird, but all these countries that you think, I don't know, you'd never imagine it being for sale in China and Israel.
And it did
come so fast that it just feels, I kept making sure that I stood back and really just appreciated the moment. You know, when I was around people, I'd try to act nonchalant and, you know, like it's cool and I'm a cool dude. And then I'd have these private moments. I'd be driving home and I'd just kind of, what the hell, you know? And it quickly becomes, I mean, the idea of, you know, coming and doing something like this with you guys, coming and doing a writing podcast, it's so cool, you know, but you don't, and suddenly there's all these things that you get to do that
life
you never, you never thought of. Yeah. Your life changes, and then you get to spend your days doing what you love. It's pretty, it's a blessing. Yeah.
Can we talk a little bit about, I know that the screen rights have been sold for The Nowhere Child.
Yes.
What was
yes.
that process like?
That was, Pretty incredible. Again, I was very lucky because my agents, they're, you know, primarily screenwriting agents, so that was really good. Mm-hmm. I retained the screen. I always wanted to retain the screen rights, so that was really exciting. We had a few amazing offers, and you have these meetings with people that
do you meet in person?
I met a couple of in person, and then a couple of there was, you know, US producers who I talked to on the phone, and it was great. I remember meeting some producers in person, and they said, "Oh, we love how every character in the book has they're going through an identity crisis," and I sort of said, "Yeah, so I did that on purpose," and in my head I'm thinking, I guess they are. I don't know. You know, so a lot of that sort of stuff. Then ultimately we sold it to, you know, the book is set, you know, half in Australia and half in Kentucky. So we ended up doing a co-production between an Australian production company and an American one. The Australian one is Carver Films, who they did the Snowtown movie and Partisan, and actually I wrote a horror film that will hopefully be out soon. It just had its premiere at Sundance, and which they did. And then the American company was Anonymous Content, and they did, you know, a True Detective and Mr. Robot and all that kind of cool stuff. So it was.
So did they come as a joint proposal?
Yeah. They joined up sort of for you know, they sort of joined up for this to kind of, you know, say this is what we're going to do, and that's not uncommon. You know, you often get production companies and producers working together, but that was just such a great fit, you know, and it's really cool just to imagine what that will be like, you know.
Will you be at all involved? Do they, because you always sort of think in that fantasy of something being adapted,
yeah,
they will like want you to come and help them out.
Yeah.
Is that the case, or that's sort of a bit delusional?
It's probably. Yeah. I'll probably have, I'll definitely have a role, you know, so. Certain, I probably can't divulge too much, but, you know, hypothetically it could be a you know, a mini series, limited series.
Yep.
So it would be multiple episodes. So there'd be a writer's room. So I would definitely be involved somehow. To what extent, I'm not too sure.
Okay.
It was always something that, you know, I was really aware that if I insist on writing the screenplay,
yes,
we'll probably still get the rights all, but I don't know. I didn't want to. Part of me.
Yes.
Part of me wants to do it. If they say, "Do you want to write the screenplay?" I have to say yes. I'm designed not to. I can't say no to it. But part of me would love if they just did it on their own, because it would mean, firstly, if it's rubbish, I can say, "Yeah, it's all the book. Yeah. The book is better." You know.
True.
But it's also
You always have that up your sleeve.
Exactly. Exactly. So if I've got nothing to do with it, it's not my fault, and it means I don't have to do work, which is great. But also, it's something kind of really exciting about bringing other voices to that. And you know, as you were saying, because the protagonist is a female, we want to use you know, female showrunner and female writers, and just to kind of bring something to it that I just couldn't as a boring man. So I think that's really exciting as well. And hopefully we'll be able to announce some Wife and the Widow screen news as well soon, hopefully, yeah.
Which is a very good segue.
That was on purpose. I'm a pro. I guess that's just, yeah.
Absolutely a pro. So The Wife and the Widow is now out. What was the process like?
Now that it's out and it's been well received, I'm so relieved. You know, when people tell me they like it, I feel excited and thrilled, but also equal parts excited and relieved. And thank God, because the process was, and you know, you're going through this right now, where you know, when you write your first book, you've got forever to write it. You don't think anyone will ever read it. You have a million years to do it. So there's this real, there's this freedom in that, which you don't appreciate until you've been published. And then, not that I'm complaining, this is an amazing problem to have. But when, you know, The Nowhere Child came out and it was a, you know, bestseller and it was well received, so suddenly I had two things that I didn't have with the first book, which was a deadline for starters and an audience. And, you know, and having an audience is incredible. You know, I get all these wonderful, beautiful emails, mostly. I do get some bad ones as well. But usually they're so kind, and nearly everyone signed off with, "Can't wait to read book two. You know, I can't wait. The next book's coming out. When's it coming out? I can't wait to read it," which is so exciting. But also, and I'm glad I didn't do this, but I was often tempted to write back, "Well, listen, don't get your hopes up, because maybe the first one was a fluke. Maybe I'll, you know," because that's what was going through my brain. You know, I was constantly thinking, what if I release this one? Well, I had a contingency. So I thought, if the second one comes out and everyone hates it, then I can have a third book. I thought, like, well, if I've got one book out, and if the second one bombs, okay, I think I get one more chance, you know. But I was, Yeah, I was terrified. My publisher had to talk me down from the ledge. My wife had to talk me down from the ledge. I'd never missed a deadline ever in my life. And then with the Wife and the Widow, it was quite a tight turnaround. So it was a year, and I pushed deadlines back, and I can sort of laugh about it now, but at the time it was really my 3 a.m. thought, you know, before the first book came out, my 3 a.m. thought, I'd wake up in the middle of the night thinking, oh God, how am I going to pay rent? Oh, okay. Well, I might be a day late on rent because I have to, you know, I'm managing all this. And then suddenly my 3 a.m. thought is, oh, well, that plot point doesn't make sense. Oh, everyone's going to know I'm a fraud. You know, it's this weird kind of, the anxiety still there. It just changes. So it was really difficult. And it wasn't until I leaned into that. Okay, I'm just going to write what I would enjoy. It's not going to be too much like the first one or not enough like the first one. It's just going to be something that I would want to read. And that, as soon as I did that, I could switch off. And then I just focused. But even then, you know, the second book is another mystery thriller, but it's pretty different from the first one as well. So I really didn't know how people were going to react. It's got a huge twist in it that I thought, oh, I don't know if the twist is going to work. I don't know. But, you know, there's all these things. Mm-hmm. And because of the tight turnaround, I didn't have that long period of where you can, you know, step back from the canvas and have perspective and go back in and change. So it was such a quick turnaround and a quick process that it really was. I remember turning to my editor, I think it was a couple of days before it came out, and I said, the book's good, right? It is good. And you know, my editor Ruby was like, yeah, it's good, relax, you know. But it was really difficult and I just had no idea. And it wasn't until, the first couple of good reviews came in that I started to relax. It was, you feel the same, right?
Yeah. And I feel like people are not always sympathetic to that neuroses unless you've been through it.
Yeah.
Like it seems, it's a bit like complaining about my house is too big.
Yeah.
Or, you know,
exactly,
like
yeah. Oh, I've got too much money in my wallet.
Exactly.
Oh,
it's weighing me down.
Poor baby.
Notes.
Yeah.
Exactly. But on the topic of people writing to you, I noticed in the Nowhere Child, you have an author's note,
yes,
which is really lovely. And in it, you talk about the process for writing the book and encourage people to get in contact with you.
Yeah. And that was, it was my publisher's idea to write an author's note, but really it could have been anything. And it was basically, you know, he said, just write something to the reader. And, you know, I really thought about it and I thought about this sort of, you know, as a reader for so long, it's this really, you know, you give an author a lot as a reader. I think you give them 3 or 5 or 10 hours and you really need to get something back in return. You know, it's not just the money you're paying, it's the hours of life that you're giving them. So now that I was on the other side of that, you know, agreement, that arrangement, I just sort of wrote about that and I sort of encouraged people to get in contact. And I'm so glad I did because I've developed this, I get emails every day.
I love it. I think it is the best idea.
Yeah, it's so nice. You just create this, it's a real connection.
Well, also as a reader reading that, you think, I can totally write to him. Whereas I feel like reading another book, there feels like more of a barrier, but that feels like an intimate
exchange. No, and it was, there's really no reason to have that barrier. You know, it was funny though, when I first started to get emails, I didn't want to reply too quickly because I wanted to give the illusion that I was a bit, you know, I was a bit more important and I was a bit more busy than I actually was. So I would wait 24 hours. Like, well, I'll let it sit in my inbox for 24 hours because I can't. Yeah, it's really like dating. But now I am actually, you know, now the time, I do have a little less time on my hands. So it's, you know, genuine the amount of time it takes me to write back to someone. But I do write back to every single one because it's so, I don't know, it's just so, I feel so sort of blessed that people feel the need to reach out. And it's a strange, you know, when you write a book, you put it out into the world and you don't get to, you know, I was in Sundance recently for this horror film and you get to sit in an audience and you get to have people react and you get to kind of experience it with them. But with a book, you don't get that. And I think when you reach out to readers and they reach out to you, that's the closest you get. You can kind of live through them. I do get some bad emails though. I got this email. I got a couple of really nasty ones, and one of them from the first book was, you know, because the sort of the central romance in the first book is a gay relationship. It's two men, and I got this email from this woman who I won't tell you her name, but by the end of this story, it'll be quite easy to figure out. She reached out to me, and it was this awful homophobic. It was awful. It was this really, really homophobic, disgusting email, you know. And I wrote back to her and. Very well constructed email, but sort of severing ties, you know, like, well, I'm going to continue to represent all, you know, I was really on my high horse. And then I didn't hear from her. And I wasn't satisfied, you know, and I was thinking, oh, I'm still so thirsty for revenge. So in the second book, I created entirely for spite, out of spite, I created a lesbian character to name after her. And now people are coming up to me saying, you know, oh, I love this character. You should write a series with her in the lead. And I'm thinking, maybe I will. Maybe it'll just be this revenge series. So they're not all nice. They're not all nice emails. But if they're not, you can get revenge. And actually, I do nice things as well. Just so you know, I'm not an asshole. You know, there was a woman who reached out who. This is a really sad email, how she read the book and she was in bed with her cat and the cat was dying of cancer. It was really sad. So I wrote a cat into the book and named the cat after her. So it's kind of like nice. You kind of build up this sense of community and a lot of people share really beautiful things with me and really personal things. And you know, there was one about a woman whose husband was going blind, and so she would read my book to him and it was this beautiful thing, but then she confessed in the email that she had skipped ahead and read the ending, but now she had to pretend, but he would know because, you know, he's going blind. It's this really nice, I don't know. It's really nice. Yeah, exactly. And it breaks down that barrier a bit. So, yeah.
Okay. We are going to finish with advice for other writers.
Yes.
Do you have any?
Yes. Well, two bits of advice. The first bit is really boring. It's sort of like when you ask someone, what's the best way to lose weight? And you have to say, you've got to exercise and eat right. You know, it's really boring, but it's true. So the first bit of advice is just read a lot and write a lot and just find time to be doing both. You know, often reading's easier than writing, but just find times to be doing as much. Because unless you're a literary genius, which there are many of you out there, but I hate you if that's you, if you're like me, you really need to write a lot and purge all the bad stuff. So that's my advice. And also read what other people are doing and be inspired by that. And the other bit of advice is enter competitions and reach out to people, because as I was saying earlier, I was cynical about competitions, but since being on the other side of you know, getting published and everything, being on the other side of it, I realize, which should have been obvious, but it wasn't, is that publishers, agents, they need your stories. They need your, you know, when you're not published, you look at publishers and they're these kind of, you know, they're these gods, they're the giants, and you've got to please them and beg to them. And they need your work as much as you need them. So when you, just submit and send off. And also, as a third bit of advice, but don't wait for it to be perfect either. I wasted, I think, years of my life and career trying to perfect things. And you know, publishers and agents, they're not looking for the perfect work. They're looking for something that's got a cool story and cool characters that's actually not perfect, so they can bring something of themselves to it. So yeah, I think that's it. Just submit and don't wait too long.
That's great advice. Thanks for being on the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Christian White, do you have a debut writer's recommendation?
I absolutely do. I was lucky enough recently to read an advance copy of The Safe Place. It's a novel coming out by Anna Downs, and it comes out mid-year, and it's just going to be, everyone is going to be talking about this book. It's so, I was reading it and I just thought, my first thought when I was reading it was just jealousy.
I was about to say, that's always a sign of a good book.
I was annoyed. Yeah, I was like, I wish I had written this. But then slowly that went away and I just enjoyed it. No, it blew me away and I think it'll blow everyone away.
Forward to it. I just realized I also have The First Time Quick Five.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, so you can pass on any question.
Oh, good.
Okay, for your first time, agent or no agent?
I had an agent, yeah.
Did you get an advance or no advance?
I got an advance.
ANZ or international rights?
Just ANZ. International.
Or, yep. Festivals or no festivals?
I went to a bunch of festivals.
Oh, I wish we talked about that now.
Yeah.
Any horror stories? Only interested in hearing the bad.
Oh, any horror stories? No. The first time I started doing that sort of stuff, I was, you know, would break out in sweats and I would, you know, when you first have to do a talk, I just kind of go and ramble, you know, but when I first started doing it, I would hold my little piece of paper and my hands would be trembling and, you know, I'd sort of make sure I look up and make eye contact, all that sort of stuff. So that was as scary as it was, but no real horror stories, touch wood.
And number of copies sold?
Oh, I don't know internationally. I can tell you that we're over 100,000 of The Nowhere Child in Australia and New Zealand. I don't have the international ones, but I mean, that's, yeah, crazy.
That's amazing. That's it. That's really it.
Thank you.
You can find the show notes for this episode on our website, thefirsttimepodcast.com. If you're feeling so inclined, we would love for you to leave us a review wherever you listen. This helps other people find us.
Get in touch with us via the contact page on our website or connect with the entire First Time gang on Twitter or Instagram at The First Time Pod. And don't forget, you can support us via Patreon. Go to patreon.com/thefirsttimepodcast. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to The First Time Podcast. We recorded this episode at Kathleen Syme Library on the traditional lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. The First Time Podcast is produced by Phoebe 80 and supported by Writers Victoria, the ACT Writers Centre, and our wonderful patrons.